Exodus 4:1 through 4:17. The fifth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on April 28, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
By going back and both summarizing and trying to clarify what I was saying last week, in chapter, well, even previous to chapter 3, Moses had been born and hidden away because Pharaoh had decided that he was going to kill all the male Hebrews, and eventually put into a basket, and the daughter of Pharaoh found him and adopted him and raised him as her own son. So Pharaoh had a privileged upbringing, and one that apparently led him to have high expectations for himself and what he could do for his real people, his native people, the Hebrews. And he identified with them, and he wanted to work hard. He wanted to do whatever he could to alleviate their suffering. But in doing so, he killed one of the Egyptian taskmasters who had been tormenting the Hebrews. And the response of the next day, he went back to intervene into a conflict between Hebrews, and the response of one of the Hebrews was to say, "Who made you a judge over us?" And as we go on in the narrative, apparently that was a rather stinging rebuke to him. He ended up fleeing Egypt and going into the desert, and seems to have lost both his drive to do something to alleviate the Hebrew suffering and the confidence that he could. He seemed to have lost that vision of him being someone who God had raised up particularly for that task. So when God comes to him and appears to him in the burning bush in chapter 3, Moses' response is, first of all, to say, "Who am I to go and lead the Hebrews out of bondage?" So first of all, it's questioning, am I one who is that is qualified, that has the charisma? I'm sure he's thinking, remember what happened when I killed that Egyptian? And then I went back to my people and what they said to me? What makes you think they would follow me? What makes me think they would follow me? And God's response to him is, first of all, to say, "I will be with you." And secondly, to say, he says, "I will provide a sign for you." But it's kind of like God's other signs. It's going to be really late. It takes a lot of faith before he gets to the sign. There's a lot that has to happen before he gets to the sign that's supposed to reassure him that God is with him. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, but I keep thinking back to the promise that God gave to Cain after Cain had killed Abel. God said, you will be an exile. You will wander the earth. And Cain's response is, "Oh, my punishment is too great to bear. Someone will find me and surely kill me." And God says, "I will put a mark on you. And anyone who kills you, I will punish them." And Cain's going, "Great. It's too late then. What help are you to me?" But the promise required faith to be of any significance at all. The promise required that Cain trust God in order to receive any kind of assurance from it. Well, here we've got a similar kind of situation. The sign is so late, the sign is going to be that the Israelites will worship God at Mount Sinai. Well, that will be after he has gone back to Egypt, appeared before the Pharaoh, and led all of the Hebrews out of Egypt. Very typical of God. So that's God's, that's Moses' first objection or concern that he raises. The second one then is, who are you? Having settled who Moses is, the second question is, who are you? And God's response is, I'm Yahweh. I'm the one who is. Well, again, great, wonderful. What is he saying there? How can that possibly be a helpful response? Moses is thinking, I'm going to go back to my people. I'm going to go back to the Hebrews. I'm going to say, God sent me, and he says, we're leaving. We, the slaves, in the most powerful country in the world, are going to just pick up with our families, and we're just leaving. And they're going to say, sure we are. We're just going to suffer more. So Moses wants to go back with some kind of something that he can say that will be compelling to them. Why should they do what he has to say? So he wants to know what God's credentials are. What kind of God is this? What can God say about himself that would convince the Hebrews to do what God says to do? And God's response is, I am. I am who I am, or I am that I am. Well, what is God saying there? It's possible that God is saying, I am a real God as opposed to the gods that aren't real. There are lots of gods that people worship. And it could be that the Lord is saying, I am the real God. That's possible. But it seems to me, if I were a Hebrew and Moses were to come to me and say, the God who really is, the God who really does exist, sent me to you, and he says, we're out of here, I would have two questions for Moses. One is, how powerful is he? It wouldn't matter what he wants them to do if he doesn't have the power to pull it off. What's he going to do? They get into the Red Sea and he can't part it, and he says, whoops. He can only get it halfway apart and it closes back on him. I mean, what if he doesn't have the power to come through, should he be trusted? And the second question I'd have for Moses is, does he care about us? Even if he's got the power to part the Red Sea, is he going to keep it open long enough for us to get through because he loves us? Does he care about us? Does he have our interests in mind? And those are questions that are left unanswered at this point. It's possible, however, that God is making a further, a more significant claim than that he exists as opposed to the gods who don't exist. It could be that what he's claiming is, I exist in a sense that nothing else exists. That is, my existence is necessarily prior to the existence of anything else. In other words, I'm the one who created this whole mess. I'm the one who was here before it happened and the one who made it all happen. If that's what he's saying, that's a little more significant, because then the question of God's power doesn't come into play. Just one second, I will fix this. I'm good with technology. So it could be that he's making this much more audacious claim, and that is, I'm the one who was here before anything else was here. I'm the one who created this whole mess. So the question about does he have the power is eliminated. And another question is eliminated, and that is, are things in control? Are things going according to plan? My suspicion is that he is indeed making that kind of claim. And I think as we go through Exodus, you'll see a number of indications from the author of Exodus that he points us to God's control of events. He keeps bringing us back to God's control of events. And then he goes on after saying that I am who I am. Then he points out that he is going to... He says in verse 16, "Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me.'" That is, the God who brought our people into being and who made the promises to our forefathers, he came to me saying, "I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt." So here he's addressing that other concern that I was saying I would have for Moses, and that is, God has their interests in mind. The plan is right on course. And it is now time for God to move. He is concerned about their suffering. And he points out that he is going to save them to a good land. He's going to take them out of Egypt and take them to a land with plenty. That he is going to force the Pharaoh to let them go. And in fact, they will not leave paupers, but they will leave rich. All of those indications that God does indeed care about them and have their interests in mind. Okay, so that's where we left off in chapter 3. Now, in chapter 4, Moses continues his concerns. He has other concerns. He's not done. And this dialogue between God and Moses carries on. Verses 1 through 9. "Then Moses answered and said, 'What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, "The Lord has not appeared to you." And the Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" And he said, "A staff." Then he said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail." So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. "That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you." And the Lord furthermore said to him, "Now put your hand into your bosom." So he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then he said, "Put your hand into your bosom again." So he put his hand into his bosom again, and when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. "And it shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. But it shall be that if they will not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on dry ground. And the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground." So God provides him with these three proofs, these three signs that Moses is indeed a messenger from God, that Moses has indeed spoken with God and has something for the Israelites to do. And he's got these three miracles, essentially. The first one is turning the staff into a serpent. The second one is the leprous hand, healing the leprous hand. And the third is the turning the water of the Nile to blood. Now, my suspicion is that, well, it's very tempting to take these as symbolic, that there's some kind of symbolism that is being built into physical pictures. But I don't know what the symbolism is. I read one commentary that offered these things, these suggestions for the different miracles. The first one, the staff turning into a serpent, that the staff symbolized his occupation as a shepherd, and that by laying it down on the ground, Moses was giving up his occupation as a shepherd. And when the staff turned into a serpent, that indicated that he was taking on a more difficult occupation, a more dangerous occupation. And that by taking the serpent and by the tail and it turning back into a staff, it was showing that Moses would have the ability to disarm the evil one. The serpent being the serpent. Part of the thinking is the serpent appeared to Eve in the garden. On the second one, the same commentary suggested that the leprous hand was the hand was Israel being brought close to Moses' heart. That it was leprous, that it was sick and was in need of help, in need of healing, and Moses brought it close to his heart and made it whole. And the third, the Nile meant life to the Egyptians, and Moses, by taking that water out of the Nile and turning it into blood, was showing that he had the power to destroy the Egyptians' life. I find all of those a little bit troubling, a little bit difficult, because how can you know? What would incline one to attach those meanings to those symbols as opposed to some others? I mean, there are other combinations, it seems to me, that one could come up with. I remember reading an article by Dostoevsky. He had just written, I think it was Crime and Punishment, but I don't remember for sure. He had just finished a novel and published it, and critics were responding to his novel, and they were writing what they thought that it meant. And one critic treated it as an allegory and saw everything as symbolic and was giving meaning to each symbol. And Dostoevsky wrote an article for a journal in which he became furious at this particular critic, because he said, if you take that approach, the novel could mean anything, because you could invest any meaning that you want into the different things that take place, into each symbol. And he said, then it's not my novel that you're reading. And that's the problem I have constantly with symbolism, is unless there's some way that you're steered towards investing a particular significance into a symbol, then how do you know what significance to attach to that symbol? How do you know that you're understanding it the way that the author wrote it? It could very well be that in Hebrew culture, some of these things have established meaning. Some of these symbols have taken on sufficiently clear symbols for us to know what to plug in, and then more importantly, that the readers, when this was written, knew what to plug in for each symbol. For instance, the serpent. That is a symbol that we find in Genesis. We do have the serpent appearing to Eve. And it could be that he's building on that. I don't know. But I had a difficult time trying to reconstruct what the symbolism would be, a symbolism that I could feel confident with. But there is something else that is interesting about the progression of these three miracles that was striking to me, and I think might be significant. The first is that when he puts the staff down and it turns into a serpent, and then he turns it back into a staff, that's a nice trick, but it's of no use. Turning sticks into serpents is not a useful thing to do in and of itself. So quite apart from whether it has any symbolic meaning, and it may, we have the first sign being one that's of no practical use to the Hebrews. The second one, where he sticks his hand in and then pulls it back out, it's leprous. He sticks it back in, pulls it out, and it's whole. If I were a Hebrew, I'd be saying to myself, now that's more like it. That's useful. A God that has control over health and sickness, that's more interesting to me. That's more significant than one who changes sticks into serpents and back. And it says, if they do not believe or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of... Oh, this is the last sign. Let me come to that. The third one, he takes water and turns it into blood. Why blood? Why not tar? Why not wine? There are other things that could be done with water. Why does he turn it into blood? And my suspicion is that it's blood because blood is essential for life. If the blood's gone, the life's gone. So it could be that he's indicating his power over not only healing, but his power over the essence of life, life itself. And if they weren't interested in the first sign, that third one should be interesting to them. That if he's the one that controls life and death, that should be interesting to them. But other than that, I don't know what, if these are symbolic, I don't know what symbols to attach to them. I will point out a curious fact, however. Some of these miracles, the first and the third miracles, are both miracles that Moses performs for Pharaoh. What God is talking about here is what miracles that he is supposed to perform for the Hebrews to establish his credentials. But he does perform the first and the third when he goes to the Pharaoh. And both the first and the third are reproduced by the Pharaoh's magicians. And the Pharaoh discounts them as not being very creative, impressive. Okay. In any case, then, these are the three signs that God gave to Moses that he would give to show to the Hebrews as evidence that he was indeed representing God.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Jesus did the second and the third to do his credentials, to establish his credentials?
In what way?
Well, he changed water to wine.
He does change water to wine.
And he did the heal of the leprosy. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it was a leper's command.
I believe so.
I don't know anything about Paul, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. The one changing water to wine, though, it seems to me that that is different. In that I think this would be a different miracle if God had said, take water from the Nile and turn it to wine. My suspicion is it would be saying something else. But exactly how to put it together, I'm not certain. Okay, so he equips him with these signs. Then Moses has another concern, starting in verse 10. Then Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant. For I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." And the Lord said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him dumb, or deaf, or seeing, or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then, go, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say." But he said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever thou wilt." Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, "Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently, and moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And you are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and his mouth, and I will teach you what you are to do. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as God to him. And you shall take in your hand his staff, with which you shall perform the signs." So his next concern is, most people take the wording here to indicate that he stutters or something, has some kind of speech impediment. But his next concern is, I can't speak well. I wouldn't be a good representative. I wouldn't be very, I don't know what it is, compelling, impressive, whatever his concern is. God's response is, "Don't you think I know that? I made you. I'm the one who creates speech impediments. And I made you the way I made you. And yet, knowing that, I'm telling you to go back to the Hebrews and lead them out of Egypt. I think this is a very interesting and significant passage when we think about self-esteem. When I was younger, I can remember very consciously thinking about different things that were going on in my life and evaluating whether I was good or whether I was worth anything, whether I was valuable. And typically what I would do in my mind is I would think, well, I'm pretty good at X. I can remember one time very specifically, I was thinking, I'm getting pretty good at basketball. I'm fairly good at basketball. And then I would go and play against people who were much better. And afterwards I think, that's pretty devastating. I didn't play as well as I thought I could. I guess I'm not as good at basketball as I thought I was. And then go through kind of a crisis. Well, how do I cope with this? And the way I would cope with it is I'd say, well, but I'm better at math. There was always a compensation. It was always, well, if I'm not as good here as I thought I was, then there must be some other area in my life where I am better. And as I reflected on it, my mentality was, I never said this to myself, but it was kind of, I have to be in the top 10% of something to be valuable. If I'm not in the top 10% in some area, then I'm no good. I'm of no value. I'm not important. And it took me a long time to realize that I was doing that and to start thinking about, well, what if, as it seems to be turning out, what if I'm mediocre in everything? Can there be no value now? Am I inherently without value and hopeless? But God's response to Moses, I think, is significant, because what he's saying is, I made you mediocre. Don't you know? Don't I know that you're mediocre? And yet the implication is, at least for Moses was made exactly the way God wanted him to be made for the task that God gave to him. Speech impediment and all. He may have been short and fat. We don't know. He may have been tall and fat. We don't know. But all the characteristics that he had were characteristics that were given to him by God for the task that he had. If God made speech impediments, he does all the other things as well. All of the other things are of his creation, and therefore a reason. And in fact, I think we'll see that the speech impediment does serve a purpose here. It's all part of what God is orchestrating right from the beginning. It seems to me that that would be true. It's the same God. If God can say that he makes Moses a speech impediment, it's true that he is in control of the characteristics that we have as well. Moses had a particular task that God had assigned to him in life, in this huge drama of human history. And Moses' part is a really significant part. Most of us probably have more humble roles. But nevertheless, God has customized us to fit the part that he has created for us to play. So for me to say, I would like to not have, I can't play that part because of X, that is tantamount to saying to God, I don't want my part. I refuse to take my part, the part that you created for me and assigned to me. And in therefore, it is rebelliousness. Sure. Yes.
How does that fit in?
I think that is an interesting observation on the part of Stephen when he's giving that account. I think Stephen is making a different distinction. Moses is making the distinction between, he's talking about aesthetically, he is slow of speech. What is he? I have never been eloquent. I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. But I think Stephen is saying there is a sense in which he was really powerful when he spoke. What made it powerful was not the aesthetics, but rather the fact that he spoke for God. It was the content, the authority behind it. And those are two different things. Moses is saying, my speech is not aesthetically pleasing. But Stephen is indicating that as God spoke through him, it was powerful, it was authoritative. That's a common, I think, tendency on our part, is to misplace value. That what Moses is doing is placing value on the beauty of and the eloquence of speech, and thinking that that's what's really important, that's what's really valuable. And Stephen is saying, look, think about it. That's neither here nor there. What does it matter if he's slow? What does it matter if it doesn't come out right? What's important is, what kind of content is there? What kind of authority does he speak with? And that he had. Yes.
I think a couple weeks ago we talked about misconstruing calling. Moses had a sense of calling, and you extrapolate to us personally and say, how do we know if we're called or not of God? And here, Moses, like here you're right, you're extrapolating from Moses's speech, his weakness. God had planned him that way for a purpose. And often that is used where all of us have weaknesses, flaws, deformities, whatever it may be. And yet we can say God has purposed that. That's part of God's plan. You know, and then we'll go into the New Testament, you know, Ephesians, you know, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I think God has created us and all that we are. But I personally struggle with a lot of inadequacies in my own life and am blind to how they play out in this cosmic drama of the function of the Lord God. You know, and I can argue, well, you know, character is the result. But I often question the logic from which our arguments come. You see what I'm saying? How we extrapolate from one, from, let's say, Moses' inability to speak so smoothly, and yet we impose it into every little thing about us as, hey, you know, man, God made you who you are, brother. Let's praise him about those things. Does that make sense to you?
Well, let's see. Let me respond. Let's see if I'm responding, if my response addresses what you're saying. God's response to Moses is, Moses saying, but I don't have the right qualities. Don't you realize, God, I don't have the right qualities to do what you're asking me to do. God's response is, I made you the way you are. Now, it seems to me that an implication of that is, God has made all of us the way that we are. God had a specific, we can see here, God had a specific thing that he wanted Moses to do. And he makes that quite clear. For us, it's it's less clear exactly what we're supposed to be doing, what our calling is. That I grant. But I think that even if we can't write down on a piece of paper what our calling is, that in fact we do have some kind of role to play that God has laid out ahead of time.
Right. I have no trouble with that. It's so easy, like when Moses is, use this example of Moses' inability to speak well, just like with Paul, God uses that to really bring about his own glory, taking something that is, for all intents and purposes, is a poor choice, and yet accomplishing his
yes.
will.
Yes.
My struggle is how we extrapolate from one example like that to every little facet of inadequacy of our lives, and use that oftentimes as an argument for God's grace to abound, to bring about his accomplished purpose in our lives. And to me, that is so damn nebulous. It's nonsensical.
So that's a teaching that you've heard in
it permeates your theology across the board.
One thing that what you're saying though brings to mind is we all have built into us certain strengths and weaknesses. Some of those weaknesses are not just like a speech impediment, but they are moral weaknesses. And it seems to me that that an implication of even of what it says here with respect to Moses is that even those weaknesses have been built into us by God. That does not mean, though, that it is right and proper for us, as we play out our role, to give in to those weaknesses. It does not justify those kinds of actions. Some of those weaknesses have been given to us in order to make part of our role in this drama of human history a noble struggle against that weakness or those weaknesses. And you see that all the time. People that have really severe moral kinds of weaknesses, and they fail and they fail and they fail. And you look at them and you say, it is sad. And we don't know how that struggle is working out between them and God, what exactly is happening, what kind of weaknesses and the nature of those weaknesses that God built into them from the beginning. But one can fail and fail and fail and still have a noble role in God's drama. And the noble role is that struggle against those weaknesses. It seems to me that in this drama, the way to think about it is all of us have a part to play, but we don't know what that part is. There are big and flashy parts, and there are supporting cast kinds of things. And we have no control over that. God has written the script. We don't have any control over how significant our role is. But the way we need to look at our role is we need to play the most noble role. Given the material that I have, I need to perform it in the most noble way that I can. That is, I need to respond to my weaknesses and say, by the grace of God, I will fight against those weaknesses and do what's right. And I will use those strengths in a way that glorifies and edifies God. and the people around me. And that's what shapes our, that's what ends up shaping the role that we play. Yes?
It seems to me that God was saying to Moses, you think your speech problem is a biggie. It's not a biggie. I mean, the way I would look at that more is not, it's more like when my kids come to me and say, they blow something completely out of proportion that just has nothing to do with the thing, and I say, it's not a biggie.
Just putting things into perspective.
Moses has decided that it's this part of his life that he's really concerned about that's going to keep him in God, and it goes, oh, you have a speech pattern? It's like, it's not a biggie, I'm gonna be doing the talking, not you.
Mm-hmm. To go further, though, I think he would, whatever objection Moses might have raised about his inadequacy for the job, I think God's response would have been the same. Don't you think I know that you're inadequate? It doesn't matter. Because I will essentially be doing it through you.
But that's what he was asking Moses to believe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes?
He's saying that not only do I not know that, I'm making it.
Mm-hmm.
And making me that way of knowing that I, this is the job I want to be doing.
Yeah. I've got this job. I gave you the characteristics that you have.
Right.
And God's saying, it's a match.
It's kind of like what you're saying about this effort that we're... We need to make in terms of striving to do the right thing. And this is Moses's issue, and this is where God has Moses, and this is how Moses is supposed to struggle with what God has called him to do, given who God has made him to be, how God has made him. This is his struggle. This is where God has him living his life. Right there. He's not perfect. He's not, whether physically or morally, this is the deal. There it is.
Yeah. The issue is Moses saying, I am not up to the task. And God's response is just to assure him, he's reassuring him that God is up to the task. God has things well in control, and God is able to make up for whatever deficiencies Moses has to perform the task. Let me see. Let me read just the next section, 18 through 23, and we'll stop there. Oh, wait. No, I need to say some other things before we go on. Well, it's a choreographer. We'll just stop here, and I will pick up here next time.